everyone. Thanks for being here. I really appreciate your participation in these videos. Namu Myoho Rengekyo. Thank you so much. We're in the midst of the selection of the time, Gosho. And this is one of the more academic Gosho. So it can seem like you really have to slog through it. And for my part in that, I apologize if I start to sound, I don't know, scholastic or whatever that is. When you listen to a teacher in class and it just sounds like you're ready to tune out. I don't want that to happen. There's an interesting thing that happens in these kinds of Gosho. Especially when Nichiren uses, as he often does, the question and answer format. This selection of the time is an incredibly broad study of the scholastic output of Buddhism. And it's impossible to talk about that scholarship without demonstrating over almost 3,000 years how it's sometimes been taken over by regional, political, or personal gain and shifted, and how it's won favor, lost favor, and meandered through the centuries. And how is it that today we can claim that we are practicing Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching? It seems almost impossible to say that. We struggle to do it with Einstein. Physics and mathematicians today, even within a century of his papers, are looking for incompleteness, errors, challenges, expansions on Einstein's amazing work. But we still know when we're reading Einstein what it is that Einstein has said and documented. Will we be able to say that in 500 years? 1,000 years? Some of you might say, will we be here? The point is that time can be a very fickle thing. The way we understand the world when we're 30 years old versus when we're 14 years old, the world hasn't changed that much. It appears to us socially to have changed, but that is in fact the ingredient, right? The socialization of humans constantly expands our awareness of the human experience. But the planet really hasn't changed much, nor the universe, nor that cycle of energies that we are formed of from, right? But as you go through your teenage years, it certainly seems to be changing a lot and fast. That slows down over time. And as we get older and older, reflection becomes more a part of our daily awareness of life. Right? So if you can try to extrapolate the kind of major shifts that you go through in your life to the maintaining of core ideas, as in Buddhism, and how they might take off in other directions, because of the environment, because of changes in the way people think, the ability they have to think at a certain level, ego, avarice, politics, favor, money, land, so many factors ply this academia, right? Even in our present day, how many arguments can you have with people about funding the arts? from food stamps to arts to tax breaks. I mean, we're constantly roiling in who's better, who deserves what. Why are you asking? What status am I going to punish you with? Or prohibit you from, just by labeling you something. It's exhaustive. It's truly exhaustive. So I want to encourage you, although this is one of those lengthy go shows, one of the things that happens in this that I'm observing as I reread it is that many things that we've slogged through already in the naming and the movement of Buddhist scholarship from Shakyamuni's day through into China, Korea, Japan, who are the main players. Although that's a lot of information, you might go, oh, history lesson, snore. What'll happen is it all comes back in a different form as Nichiren does this Q&A to better understand what's actually occurring and why Buddhism keeps self-correcting and how and who are the players in this. And what becomes obvious then, even though this may seem like a lot of data that, hey, I don't need this to practice Buddhism, but when you read in the Lotus Sutra that in the fifth 500-year period, the great teaching will be lost. And then somehow it comes back to be propagated abroad, broadly all over the world. How can it be lost and found in that way? So you may have little flies or gnats buzzing in your mind about, yeah, I'll just let that go. But it's these kinds of go-sho that wipe that slate clean and allow you to now know with confidence. So this is one of, I would say, of the aspects of practicing Buddhism that is, maybe the most troublesome in our modern times, is that we live in a time where we not only gloss over things really quickly, but we gloss over things at such a pace that we begin to rely on our impressions of things, and then we stand staunchly in guard of those implications of things and those similes of things, and we lose our foundation in truth, in actual fact, and we start getting wishy-washy. And so if one day we get up and we just go, screw all of this, and we go do something else, we don't perceive the gravity of that situation because we've never really invested deeply into the core of things. We're just kind of glinting along the top like butterflies, right? Excuse me. So I think this is a dangerous thing to do with those aspects of our lives that are core, fundamental to our lives. Our practice of Buddhism needs to be very strong. And for that strength to have any meaning, to be truly strong, it must be built on a foundation of strength, a foundation of clarity. Because that kind of clarity, even though we don't have to think about it every day, once it's made, once that clarity is in our minds, then it's much more difficult to walk away from because we have a sense of depth of meaning and practice and integration on a cellular level that is more and more difficult to simply walk away from. Does that make sense? So there is a great value to these treatises, these go-sho. So this is one of the reasons I wanted to do this series, because I remember even for myself, that there were times when, oh man, these ghost shows are endless, right? And so in a way, I'm glad that I can do this and break it up into parts, but I also find myself wondering if these ghost shows wouldn't be more meaningful if they were done all in one shot. Of course, that would require some kind of invitation to you to come to my temple here, my school, and spend a week while we sat around campfires and orated and discussed one ghost show. I think there's a certain amount of I romance that idea a bit. I think that could be, really amazing. I wish I could do that with you guys. There's a goal we can put at our altars, that before I leave this planet, I will have the opportunity to have great campfires of Gosho or just Buddhist study in general. It'll take a lot of Daimoku so that we don't digress into just argumentation. But I don't know. I think our Sangha is pretty solid that way. I know a lot of you are longtime practitioners like myself. I can't tell you how deeply I appreciate your participation in these things and that I can be a part of your practice. Thank you. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. All right, lest I make this a 3-hour video of appreciation, which I think I could do. Let's get back to it. With all of that in mind, and continue with selection of the time. Question. In the latter part of the Tang Dynasty, the Tripitaka master Pu Kung introduced to China a treatise in one volume entitled The Treatise on the Mind Aspiring for Enlightenment. Some of you may know that one. Whose authorship he ascribed to Bodhisattva Nagarjuna. The great teacher Kobo says of it, quote, "This treatise represents the heart and core of all the 1,000 treatises of Nagarjuna." What is your opinion on this? Now, this is really interesting because if you've done any research on Nagarjuna, there still to this day are kind of little footnotes among academicians as to what is Nagarjuna and what is not Nagarjuna. Some have even posited, like Shakespeare, by the way, that Nagarjuna was 2 different people at different times. Anyway, all of that is for another talk. Nichiren answers. Now, Nichiren is a scholar of the umpteenth level, right? So there's some gravitas to Nichiren's words on these kinds of things. So let's see what he says. This treatise consists of 7 leaves. There are numerous places in it that could not be the words of Nagarjuna. Therefore, in the catalog of Buddhist texts, it is sometimes listed as a work of Nagarjuna and sometimes as a work of Pu Kung. The matter of this authorship, so this dispute's been going on for centuries, right? But now as Nichiren continues, he starts to shed light on the situation. The matter of its authorship has never been resolved. In addition, it is not a summation of the lifetime teachings of the Buddha and contains many loose statements. To begin with, a vital passage, the one asserting that, quote, only in a true word teaching can one attain Buddhahood in one's present form, end quote, is in error, since it denies the fact that the Lotus Sutra enables one to attain Buddhahood in one's present form, a fact well attested by both spiritual passages and actual events. When he says actual events, he means in the Lotus Sutra, when the Dragon King's daughter attains enlightenment immediately. There's other examples. Anyway, that's what he means. Instead, it asserts that the True Word Sutras enable one to attain Buddhahood in one's present form, an assertion for which there is not the slightest proof in scriptural passages or actual events. That one word, only, in the assertion that only in the True Word teachings can one attain Buddhahood in one's present form, is the greatest error of all. Now, we're going to deal with something in translation, I think, because the translator is going to shift between error and mistake as he's talking about Bukung here. And as evidenced by Nichiren's own words as we go on here, it will become obvious what Nichiren is saying. It's no mistake. This was an intentional error. And that's how it should be translated. Nevertheless, you'll see what I mean when we get to it. I will doubtless point it out. He goes on. In view of the facts, it seems likely that the work was written by Pukung himself, who, in order to ensure that the people of the time would regard it with sufficient gravity, attributed it to Nagarjuna. Here we have the core of the matter. Pukung went to India, came back to China and said, I am the premier, I know the right teaching. Because look, I got this document from Nagarjuna, who is a very well-respected name historically. And so he comes in and says, I got this from the boss. This is how we go. And he wants to do that because he can edify himself, gain favor of the people, the ruler, the region, get money, get support, da 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 da. I'm sorry this is happening in Buddhism. It's very capitalist thinking, isn't it? But that's the nature of man. So how these things don't completely derail Buddhism? How do we get back to the truth? That's the history. That's what we're reading about. Yeah, it does derail Buddhism in certain areas, but it doesn't eviscerate or get rid of the truth, which is still there being maintained. It's very regionally taken apart. Fortunately, because Buddhism is such a strict practice from its outset, there always comes along someone who's very academic, who wants to get it right, who has the courage, once he or she gets there, to call into question these other erroneous bozos. And they, because of, for all our fallacies as human beings, we do have a great admiration and reverence for correctness in all things. It's a strange conundrum, isn't it? But thank goodness, because this is what always puts the tail behind the dog again, instead of the tail wagging the dog, right? All right, Sylvain, what did that mean? Get things in the proper order and correct path. That's what I meant. Okay. So, where are we here? Okay, Pukung makes a number of other errors as well. Thus, in his translation of the rules of rituals based on the Lotus Sutra, which deals with the Lotus Sutra, he defines the Buddha of the Lifespan chapter as the Buddha Amida. Wow! With what we know now, how is he able to get away with that one? It's incredible. So in essence, this clever guy, Pukung, because he understands as an intellectual that the Lifespan chapter, which is the basis of Nichiren's teaching, right? Hundreds of years later. Maybe 1,000 years later. Anyway, he knows that the Lifespan chapter is the chapter where, the drop the mic moment when Shakyamuni Buddha tells everybody, hey, I'm a human being and I attained enlightenment. But that's not because that enlightenment belongs to me. That enlightenment is enlightenment time immemorial. All of us have it. All this is why it is innate, and that we can all experience this Buddha-ness in our current life. All we have to do is awaken it, invoke it. That's all I've done. You can have the exact same Buddhahood as I have, that you've been listening to for 40 years, 40 some odd years, 50 some odd years, actually, as he's preaching the Lotus Sutra. What a revelation. Yet somehow Pukung re-envisages, and I don't know how he distorted the language of it or whatever, but he was able to say, well, but the Buddhahood that Shakyamuni was talking about in the Lotus Sutra is Amida Buddha. So, you know, forget about that Shakyamuni guy. He won't get you anywhere. It's this Amida guy who's a conjured presence or personage of Shakyamuni's as a teaching tool. Pukung makes him the lofty goal of Buddhism. And it speaks to, and I have to say this, it speaks to the capacity of the people at the time. Because as I'm saying this to you, you're thinking, yeah, how crazy is that? Because your capacity is much higher. This is why this is the time to propagate the Lotus Sutra, because our innate ability to understand simple logic without magic, without magical thinking, right? So I just, as I read this, it just stuns me. So that's why I have to pause and see, check with you guys. Do you hear this? Do you hear what he's saying? Okay. And so Nichiren says, lifespan chapter is Amida Buddha, an obvious and glaring mistake. Now, mistake? That's no, you know, mistake implies that, oops, my bad. No, that was clearly intentional. So that's no mistake. That's an intentional, hesitate to call it an error. That's a manipulation, right? He also claims, Pukung, that the Dharani chapter of the Lotus Sutra should follow immediately after the Supernatural Powers chapter, and that the Entrustment chapter should come at the very end. Views that are not even worth discussing. So he's actually changing the order of the chapters of the sutra to kind of move things into a different interpretation of the entire documents. This guy's a piece of work. But, you know, Republicans and Democrats do the same thing all day long, so. That is not all, he goes on to say. He stole the Mahayana precepts from the Tendai school, and obtaining support in the form of a command from Emperor Taizong, there's that power grab, established them in the five temples of Mount Wutai, and he decreed that the classification of doctrinal tenets used by the Tendai school should be adopted for the True Word school as well. So he just sort of, you know, slid it over. On the whole, he did many things to confuse and mislead the world. It is acceptable to use translations of sacred texts by other persons, but translations of sutras or treatises from the hand of Pukung are not to be trusted. So, wha-bam! When both old and new translations are taken into consideration, we find that there are 186 persons who have brought sutras and treatises from India and introduced them to China in translations. With the exception of one man, the Tripitaka master Kumarajiva, all of these translators have made errors of some kind. But among them, Pukung is remarkable for the large number of his errors. It is clear that he deliberately set out to confuse and mislead others. Finally, he says it. This was deliberate. Question. How do you know that the translators other than Kumarajiva made errors? Do you mean not only to destroy the Zen, the Nembutsu, true word, and others of the seven major schools, but to discredit all the works of the translators that have been introduced to China from and Japan? This is an interesting one now. This is getting hot. Answer. This is a highly confidential matter. So as I said going into this Gosho, this is a heavy one. So if you're still learning about Buddhism, about Nichiren, about the Lotus Sutra, don't be, you know, dissuaded in any way by, what shall I say, you know, when we eat a dessert and it's really, really rich, it's like we can only take tiny little bites, as opposed to, you know, when we get a chocolate eclair and we just bury our face in it. That might be a little bit too autobiographical, but do you see what I mean? I don't want you to feel discouraged in any way, because this just seems a little too many terms that you're not familiar with, too many forms of argumentation, all of that. That's okay. Take a break. Back off. Do something simpler. But I also want you to know, no matter what stage of study you're in, this stuff is all going to make an impact in your confidence, in your resolve of practicing Buddhism. So in that way, I encourage you to stay the course. There's always something to grab out of these Gosho at any level of study that you're at. So, he says, I should discuss it in detail only when I am face to face with the inquirer. Of course, he didn't have internet and YouTube then, right? However, I'm not making light of it. I guess I'm just trying to justify what I'm trying to do here. However, he says, I will make a few comments here, so it won't get too nitty-gritty. Kumarajiva himself said, quote, when I examine the various sutras in use in China, I find that all of them differ from the Sanskrit originals. How can I make people understand this? I have only one great wish. My body is unclean, for I have taken a wife. But now you know the history on that, right? That doesn't really apply to us today, except that, point made, when we get into sexual relationships, our own personal drive is mitigated, always. That's just the nature of how we're built as human beings. And certainly throughout the centuries in early Buddhist teachings and middle Buddhist teachings, there were many privations, right? It's historical. Monks in their monasteries, staying away from women, staying away from any, not just women, but any, sensual passions of being out and about. Just seeing men, women, cavorting, being men and women, very, very distracting to the Buddhist monk's commitment, building his commitment or her commitment to the Buddhist teachings. So we went into isolation, and that was a big part of the earlier teachings, Hinayana mainly, but even into Theravada and early Mahayana teachings, all these precepts, they were called, right? These precepts of not eating certain things, not drinking certain things, staying away from garlic, staying away from people, staying away from women, staying away from anything that would spark your earthly desires, the desires of human beings. So it's not unlogical to think that early on, and when I say early on, I mean the first 1,000 years of Buddhism, first 500 certainly, that in order to attain Buddhahood, you really had to be distinct from the population. You couldn't be just hanging around with people and being social. It was a matter of outside of the human realm that you were trying to reach, right? This whole rhetoric of the pure land, this other place. This is a feature of many, many religions, right? So early on, you could justifiably say that Buddhism was a religious practice, you know, daily enforcement, privations, all of that. But that wasn't the core teachings of Buddhism. That was Shakyamuni trying to elevate the thinking of the people in his time, the capacities they had. But even in his own lifetime, as he got to his last 8 years as a human being, he was sure to have brought people along to, even if it was just a small percentage of them, who were capable of understanding that all these privations and so forth were mental adjustments, that they didn't have to live in that way. That to attain Buddhahood is accessible to anyone. Right? All you have to do is study, strengthen your resolve to be with Buddha, with your own Buddha, with what's the statement Nichiren makes? To single-mindedly join the Buddha, right? It's an experience in this lifetime. The Pure Land is a mental state, right? When you divorce yourself from all of these attachments, even though they exist everywhere, you're in samsara. When you divorce yourself from the influence of these things and you can see the world clearly, beautifully, lift all that weight off of you, that is the Pure Land. That is your Buddha wisdom. Right? Okay. So he says, my body is unclean, for I have taken a wife. All right? But my tongue alone is pure and could never speak false words concerning the teachings of Buddhism. After I die, make certain that I am cremated. If at that time my tongue is consumed by the flames, then you may discard all the sutras that I have translated. End quote. Such were the words that he spoke again and again from his lecture platform. As a result, everyone, from the ruler on down to the common people, hoped that they would not die before Kumarajiva so that they may see what might happen. It's pretty morbid, us human creatures. Okay, he claims he's being so forthright and so honest, and that his words are reliable, that when he dies, cremate him, and if his tongue burns, then we'll know it was all crap. But if his tongue doesn't burn, then we'll know he was telling the truth all along. Okay, I think that's enough of an assertion for me to get that this guy really, really feels confident in his translations, that he's in no way manipulated any of the language, that this is as the Buddha taught. I get it. I get his conviction. Oh, no, but I have doubt. I'm going to wait till he dies so I can see if his tongue burns, and then I'll be able to, ha, ha. That's so silly. But anyway, such is the storytelling of Buddhism and all over the world, really. Again, a demonstration of samsara, humans. So eventually Kumarajiva died and was cremated, and his impure body was completely reduced to ashes. Only his tongue remained, resting atop a blue lotus that had sprung up in the midst of the flames. It sent out shining rays of five-color light that made the night as bright as the day, and in the daytime outshone the rays of the sun. This, then, is why the sutras translated by all the other scholars came to be held in little esteem, while those translated by Kumarajiva, particularly his translation of the Lotus Sutra, spread rapidly throughout China. So, this is a story, doubtless. But it is quite a, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, words escape. But Nichiren's endorsement of Kumara Jiva's translation of the Lotus Sutra is a very powerful thing to note in the context of this Gosho. And he says it in other places, but in the context of this Gosho, those of you who are just starting out, who may not have read a Gosho or not been exposed to this one particularly, this is the kind of thing that you can note, because you've been told, yeah, there are many, maybe you don't know, but I know when I first started, I didn't really realize that there were many translations of the Lotus Sutra, even by contemporary academics. So there are translations inside the Buddhist order and outside the Buddhist order. There are translations in the Buddhist order that have a lineage that goes back to Kumara Jiva, and there are some translations that go back to other translators, which now, in the light of this dialogue, we have right to question. Do you see? This is the scholarship part. There's an early translation, 19th century translation, late 1800s, from H. Kern, K-E-R-N. I particularly like that translation. It's obviously admired in his cultural reality of Christianity. The language he uses, the you know, everything from blessed to holy and amen, it's all in there. But it's so glaring, in fact, that it's easy to dismiss, or it's easy to convert into real terms. However, his translations are so direct, the sense of them is so direct, that if you're aware and you can remove the Christian overtones, the information, the meaning of each chapter, it comes through very, very clearly. And so that when you read more than one translation, Kern's and Watson's and the Kosekai's, I have them listed in the Lotus Sutra videos that I've done through each chapter. I kind of dance around in the different versions that I have four or five of them, and it's fascinating to see how that helps break your bond to the words, and you start to see the impression, the sense, the meaning being discussed here. It becomes even more clear. I know it did to me. We have to be cautious as students that we don't get hung up on the way a sentence is written and the exact words. Yes, we need those things. That's how we communicate. But we need to think beneath, beyond, around those words, sense the implication, the meanings in that assemblage of words and sentences and paragraphs, right? So, next question. Where are we time-wise? A little more time. Tell us, that tells us about the translators who lived at the time of Kumara Jiva or before. But what about later translators such as Shan Wu Wei or Pukung? There are more than one Pukung. Answer. Even in the case of translators who lived after Kumara Jiva, if their tongues burned up when they were cremated, it means that there are errors in their work. The Dharma characteristic schools in earlier times enjoyed a great popularity in Japan. But the great teacher Dengyo attacked it, pointing out that though the tongue of Kumara Jiva was not consumed by flames, those of Xuan Tang and Tsu En burned along with their bodies. So basically discrediting these Dharma characteristic school people. Emperor Kamu, impressed by his argument, transferred his allegiance to the Tendai Lotus School. That was what Dengyo was teaching. In the third and ninth volume of the Nirvana Sutra, we find the Buddha predicting that when his teachings are transmitted from India to other countries, many errors will be introduced into them, and the chances for people to gain enlightenment through them will reduce. This is the nature of translations and cultures, cultural understandings of things, right? So Shakyamuni knew this. Therefore, the great teacher Miao Lo remarks, quote, whether or not the teachings are grasped correctly depends upon the persons who transmit them. It is not determined by the sage's original pronouncement. In other words, if you are reading, texts that are unbeknownst to you being manipulated or converted into meaning something other than what they originally meant, and you don't get the result that you're looking for, this is not just Buddhism, but anything, you can't blame the teaching. You can't say this manual that I'm following from Bob here, this method of dieting or whatever it is, it's total horseshit because it never worked for me. Excuse me. It's total baloney, right? It's not the fault of the teacher or the doctor who came up with that diet idea and what he was trying or she was trying to accomplish. We don't even know that. All we have is Bob's document that has his impression and what he wants you to believe and do. And if it doesn't work out, then Bob's to blame, not the teaching. So this is what Miao Lo is saying, is when you learn from all these translations, errors or not, if you don't get the result, then don't blame Buddhism. Don't blame Shakyamuni Buddha. It's not that he didn't know what he was doing. It's that whoever your teacher is was mistaken, either, as Nichiren was pointing out, deliberately or even by accident, right? It depends on their level of understanding. Going on, he is saying that no matter how the people of today may follow the teachings of the sutras in hopes of a better life hereafter, if the sutras they follow are in error, then they can never attain enlightenment. But that is not to be attributed to any fault of the Buddha. Because the Buddha is the Buddha. The Buddha, you already have the Buddha. This isn't about Shakyamuni. This is about your Buddha nature. And if your course of study doesn't help you to realize that Buddha nature, it's the course of study that you're using, not the Buddha, the original intent, right? In studying the teachings of Buddhism, apart from the distinctions between Hinayana and Mahayana, provisional and true and exoteric and esoteric teachings, this question of the reliability of the sutra translation is the most important of all. Question. You say that during the 1,000 years of the former day of the law, scholars knew in their hearts that the truth of the Lotus Sutra far surpassed the teachings of the other exoteric and esoteric sutras, but that they did not proclaim this fact to others, merely teaching the doctrines of the provisional Mahayana. This may be the case, though I find it difficult to agree. Now, this is one of those parts where things are getting pretty thick. Maybe I should leave this for another part. I know this is a heavy sutra. We have heard, doubtless you have, in countless studies about Nichiren saying, Nagarjuna, Tendai, Miao Lo, they knew the truth of the Lotus Sutra when they were teaching Buddhism, but they did not expound it broadly. And so we take that as read. That's one of those things we go, okay, Nichiren says so. But it seems like we want to know a little more, don't we? How can you say that? If the Lotus Sutra is the culmination of Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings, how could all these great bodhisattvas and scholars have just gone, meh? How do they know it, more to the point? How do they know it and not teach it? That's the subject of this Gosho, the selection of the time. And so we're going to get into that pretty deeply now. And I think because that's going to involve several pages, I'm going to leave that to the next part. It's interesting, though, that one of the things that comes up, and I'll give you this to chew on before we get to the next part. There's a lot of reference to ordination platforms. So what the heck is that, right? Do you go out in the backyard and build a deck and say, that's my ordination platform? Answer yes and no. And just to be clear, no. When in Buddhism or when in Nichiren we read about platform, think about it more in the sense of scholastic platforms, philosophical platforms, political platforms. There is a goal, a teaching, a document, a whatever, and beneath that, the supporting information is a list of requisites. And that whole list of requisites, along with its main point, is the platform of that teaching. Does that make sense? So, if I am teaching you Buddhism, okay, and my platform is that you must spend so much time in a monastery, observe the privations of behavior from the Hinayana period, and this and that, then my platform is in error. Because as the Lotus Sutra shows, all of these earlier precepts were suited to people of that time, but no longer useful. Because now the capacity of people in this time is to practice the Lotus Sutra. So the platform of the Lotus Sutra is Buddha exists, always has. Buddha is innate and inherent in your life, just as it is all life. You are not separate from that. And therefore, you can attain that awakening now in your present form. Immediate. That's the Lotus Sutra platform. And nobody preached that. Even though they talked about the Lotus Sutra. Even though they might have practiced, like Tendai. He did a tremendous amount of documentation, and we'll read about that. About the merit of the Lotus Sutra. But they still practiced all these old meditation routines and rituals. They carried that along. And so that was not in accordance with the Lotus Sutra specifically. Myoho Renge Kyo. Right? So this is the interpretation that comes into the shorter words we hear, that they knew this in their heart, but they did not propagate it widely. They understood its primacy, but they didn't unglue it from this history of asceticism, privations, precepts, so on and so forth, that really are unnecessary. If you're going to practice the Lotus Sutra, then that's what you practice. That's not that you can't study the rest of it, because, as you'll see, the Lotus Sutra is considered the ocean, whereas all of the provisional teachings are the rivers and streams that lead into it. As I've said before, the Lotus Sutra sits atop on the shoulders of all this previous scholarship. So it's not to toss it away as study material, but it's to toss it away as ritual, as practicing. It's just now, it's just study bolstering your understanding of the Lotus Sutra. Okay? So with that, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much. Support if you can. I translate all of these into podcasts so you can download them and listen to them at your convenience. And until the next one, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo.